You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia, supported by Science and Sport. Today we are in Andalo.
Cozze ci tene, cozze, cozze vicine, non spigudeci ora, non spigudeci ora.
Your teammate Stephen, again, a terrific performance from him today. You maybe don't know that yet. How was today and helping him as much as you could on what was a really fast stage, 44 kilometer an hour average today?
Oh, it was a up day, that's it. I didn't do anything.
So you're not very happy?
I'm
Is that how your sort of state of tiredness at this state in the race, stage in the race?
Oh.
You don't want to talk?
I'm just, you know. Oh.
Well, it was a very fast stage.
It was, yeah.
So is it frustrating not being able to help him?
No. Just suffered.
Is he surprising you how well he's going, Stephen?
Just a little bit, yeah. Yeah.
My name's Richard Moore. I'm joined by Daniel Freib.
Hello, Richard. Dove siamo?
Dove siamo?
Well, that's what you usually say, that, don't you? Dove I am
siamo.
Lionel.
Dove siamo?
I don't really look like Lionel, do I? We are in Andalo.
Thank you for that. We were played in there by Jos van Emden, the Lotto Jumbo NL rider, who I spoke to just after he crossed the line. I think that comes across in what he said there.
Very raw, wasn't it?
Very raw. We had to bleep it a little bit, of course,
a lot.
Being a family show. But you know, there were a few Lotto Jumbo NL riders who were in the last group that came in, and they looked quite traumatised. They'd had a very, very difficult day, and it was a very difficult day. And before we go on to discuss what happened in an eventful, breathless stage, I certainly find it breathless. I'm kind of just catching up, getting into the rhythm of things again. We should hear the tale of the tapa. Lionel Burney's no longer in the race, but let's hear his tale of the tapa.
Thanks very much, Richard and Daniel. I am back at home. I had a very relaxing day, lovely day. Had a bit of a lie-in, had breakfast in the garden, and then went out on my bike for an hour or so, stopped for a coffee and had a macchiato. Daniel, you'll be very pleased to hear, no cappuccino. It's well after 11:30 by the time I reached the cafe, but that's probably not what you're anticipating hearing. This is the tale of the tapa for Stage 16, which I watched on Eurosport, listened to Rob Hatch and Sean Kelly's commentary. It's very entertaining. It was a 132-kilometre stage from Bresanoni to Andalo. It was fast, furious and aggressive, and it was all over and done with inside 3 hours, for the leaders at least. Alejandro Valverde of Movistar won his first Giro stage at the age of 36. He beat his fellow breakaway riders, Steven Krauswijk, who's still in pink, and Ilnur Zakarin at the finish. And Krauswijk extended his lead in the pink jersey to 3 minutes over Esteban Chavez, who missed the important split and had a furious chase to limit his losses. It was another below par day for Vincenzo Nibali too. He finished 1 minute 47 behind Valverde and slipped from third to fourth overall. And so Valverde's stage win and time gain puts him third and makes him a strong contender for the podium again. Elsewhere, Ilnur Zakarin climbed ahead of Rafał Majka into fifth place, Bob Jungels jumped above Andre Amador into seventh, and Domenico Pozzovivo is into the top ten. He's now ninth. Because it was such a short, fast stage, the time limit was particularly harsh, and the gruppetto made it over the line with only a couple of minutes to spare. And that meant that the commissaires were spared a difficult decision to make. Krauswijk is still in pink by 3 minutes, Nizzolo is in the red points competition jersey, Cunego is in the blue mountains jersey, and Jungels is in white. Tomorrow is likely to be a sprint finish. Back to you chaps in Italy.
So that was Lionel there.
How is Lionel?
Well, I don't know. Well,
he's back, isn't he? He's be getting withdrawal symptoms. I think he enjoyed himself here, so I worry about him back in Watford. Anyway.
He said it was a wrench to leave. He doesn't live in Watford, incidentally, but he said it was a wrench to leave. But I'm back and getting into the groove, hopefully, again. But it's difficult to pick it up.
Well, I think it was difficult to pick it up for the riders, Rich, wasn't it? We expected an absolute tear-up. I mean, all the conditions were there for a real massacre. You know, it was after the rest day. A lot of riders struggle after the rest day. It was short. A lot of riders with a lot to gain, a lot of riders who had lost a lot on the previous two stages. And the terrain was perfect for ambushes, for surprise attacks. Well, not that much of an element of surprise, because as I said, everyone was expecting a tough race today and fast race right from the gun, and sure enough, that's what it was, wasn't it? And Esteban Chavez looked as though he was going to be the guy who got really called out early on. I mean, there were attacks at the top of the Mendola, the Paso de la Mendola, which was the first climb on the stage, and Chavez was distanced, and, well, we're going to talk about that in more detail later, but it was a tremendous rear guard effort from him and his team to get him back on, and the real loser in the end was, once again, Vincenzo Nibali.
He was, and we'll go on to talk about Nibali a bit more as well. I mean, I think it was a real test, obviously, for Stephen Creswick, who is in the pink jersey and looking more secure than ever in the pink jersey. I mean, he leads by 3 minutes now, and it's difficult really to imagine a guy in the kind of form he's in losing that sort of time in the days that remain. As we heard at the start, his team is not very strong, and I was speaking to Dave Brailsford this morning, who pointed out or said something that we all have noticed, that, you know, there are two very strong riders here in Chavez and Creswick, and two very strong teams in Astana and Movistar, whose leaders are perhaps haven't been firing on all cylinders, although Valverde still seems very strong. He won today's stage, of course. And that created a very intriguing scenario, because we imagined that Astana and Movistar would really put the pressure on, and they did. But Creswick dealt with it all easily and even went on the attack. I mean, I thought it was fascinating. Him, Valverde, and Ilner Zakarin, who came into the finish here. And Zakarin was the guy pulling at the front like he was going for time, which he is, because he's still climbing back up the overall charts. Valverde was riding for the stage win, obviously, but it looked to me like Creswick was riding for the stage win as well. He even went down to fasten his Velcro at one point on his shoes, which is like they used to tighten their toe straps in the old days for the sprint.
He did, Rich, and you know, you talk about the team and the weakness, the relative weakness of Lotto Jumbo's team, supposedly, that's what everyone thinks, but Creswick in attacking is doing exactly the right thing, because he needs to, as the strongest rider in the race at the moment, reduce it, bring it down to a fist fight effectively between single representatives of various teams, and, you know, isolate the leaders. And by attacking, you know, he knows that only Valverde can go with him. Amador can't go with him from Movistar. He knows that Nibali can go with him, but Scarponi can't. So eventually you end up there with one guy from every team, and the numerical disadvantage then disappears.
Evaporates, yeah. It takes a hell of a lot of confidence as well as strength to do that. And for a guy who's not been in this position before, he's riding with incredible confidence, isn't he?
He is, and I think he's very aware what's impressive, that he's very aware he needs to make hay while the sun shines. He knows that this form is not going to last forever. It might not even last until the end of the Giro, and it would be silly, really, to be almost starstruck by the position that he's in and be content to defend. He really needs to make as much time as possible. Now, also knowing, you know, as I keep droning on about, the altitude factor and the last two big mountain stages, Chavez should be at an advantage there, because the passes are so high. And even today, I mean, Chavez was out the back, he was chasing, but on the penultimate climb, the hardest climb of the day, to Fai della Paganella, he was the fastest rider.
By some margin, actually, he really flew up there, which suggests that his legs aren't the problem. And he told you, didn't he, that he actually made a mistake. You spoke to him at the finish.
And Matt White is DS.
Let's hear from him now.
It was a question of positioning when the group split. It wasn't your legs.
Yeah, the group split the last 500 metres for the first climb. And behind, I thought the gap is closing, because during all climb, it's a lot of attacks, but always the group come back. But in the last one, no come back.
You're a relieved man tonight.
Yeah, it's one mistake for me. And it's like this, no? Sometimes the humans do mistakes.
I know what state is that. I don't know what number it is. I don't know if it's Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
Just
I know what's coming up.
Yeah, good. Matt, you knew it was going to be aggressive, you knew it was probably going to start fast, and it did. It lived up to everyone's worst expectations, really.
Yeah, but I don't think anyone could have predicted that scenario, a climb so far from the finish. But yeah, it was an entertaining day for everyone, I think.
And are you relieved in the end, because he's really limited his losses, and it was a great rear guard action?
Oh, it was. Look, Damien Housen and Rubens Plaza was incredible today. Incredible. They, without those guys today, maybe we would have lost two or three places on general classification. Who knows the outcome? Because as you could see, Cannondale were pinned, Saxo Bank were pinned. Now, we thought they weren't helping for a reason, and the reason was they had nothing. So our boys took full responsibility, gave Esteban every chance at the bottom of the penultimate climb. And if you look at the statistics of the Esteban was the fastest guy up there. Now, he went from 38, 40 seconds to 13 or 12 at the top. Okay, it wasn't good enough to go back to the leaders, but we certainly limited our losses.
And it was a positional thing rather than a legs thing when the group actually split and he was cut adrift.
It was 500 metres from the top. He said he was on the. He knew the climb. We reconned the climb 2 weeks ago, and he just didn't expect such a heart attack 500 metres from the top that would end up the way it did.
I feel like I'm stuck in an episode of Kilometre Zero here, Daniel.
Well, no, Rishan. This is not a repeat of our Kilometre Zero from yesterday, Pausa Café. We are in, well, you can tell it's not a repeat because we were in Cortina then, and the main language spoken in Cortina is Italian, and we're still in the very Germanic part of Italy today. We're in Bressanone, Brixen. And you heard some German voices there, didn't you?
Heard a lot of German voices, quite a few Italian as well, because we followed most of the publicity caravan into this little cafe, didn't we?
You did, Richard. But we are, I thought I'd introduce you, well, I'm sure you're aware of it already, but another morning ritual here at the Giro is, of course, reading, perusing the day's La Gazzetta dello Sport. La Gazzetta, really integral to the race and the race's history. Just browsing the headlines from yesterday. It was a rest day, of course, but big pieces on Vincenzo Nibali, Peter Sagan supposedly going to Astana. But thought we'd talk a bit about La Gazzetta and its relationship with the race.
Well, I was going to ask you about that because you obviously, that is your morning ritual to get Gazzetta every morning, as getting the L'Equipe at the Tour de France is part of the ritual there. And we always talk, don't we, about how much space is devoted to the Tour in France or the Giro here. You know, typically, I notice it's often not, it's often on the front page, but then quite well, quite deep into the paper itself comes coverage of the Giro. How much space do they devote to the Giro?
Well, generally, these days, there are about 6 or 7 pages, but hidden quite deep, like you say, Rich. I mean, it's interesting, La Gazzetta, which, of course, is the pink paper, which gives, which is the owner of the race, and the pink jersey is pink because of La Gazzetta dello Sport. But La Gazzetta actually started in 1896, and it was green. It was light green. First issue was the 3rd of April, I think I'm right in saying. In 1896, and the only sport on the front page that day was cycling. Cycling was very much the most popular sport in Italy at the time. And La Gazzetta took a few years to become pink. It started off green, then they experimented with white, and they then moved on to yellow. And finally, in January 1899, we had our first pink Gazzetta.
It's incredible how you have all these dates and just sitting there in your head, Daniel. Incredible knowledge. Tell me though, the pink jersey, did that, the Giro began in 1909, but I don't think in the early years of the Giro there was a pink leader's jersey. Just like at the Tour de France, it was, the Tour started in 1903, first yellow jersey was 1919, and there are various stories about why a yellow jersey was introduced. One was that after the First World War, it was the only material available, yellow fabric. But with the pink jersey, I think it was even later it was introduced to the Giro, am I right?
It was, but before we move on to that, I mean, similar stories exist about why La Gazzetta is pink, and also the Financial Times in the UK, I think similar stories about why that paper is pink.
I think off the top of my head, Daniel, the Financial Times became pink in 1893.
Wow. And was that, Richard, because pink paper was supposedly cheaper back then?
That's one theory, Daniel, but there was a sporting newspaper at the time that was pink, and it became an identifying feature of that paper, and I think the FT wanted to set itself apart, but also that it was cheaper.
Okay, well, two main theories with La Gazzetta. One is that, as you say, pink paper was cheaper, even in Italy. The other theory is that particular day they had run out of any other colour of paper and decided to use pink. But yeah, you're right, the Giro introduced a pink jersey quite late in its history, 1931. Armando Cugnet, who was a very long time, the first director of the Giro d'Italia between 1909 and 1948, he decided that the Giro, like the Tour, needed something to distinguish the race leader, which it hadn't had up until that point. So the pink jersey has been in existence since then, 1931. La Maglia Rosa, of course.
I mean, has that been an unbroken run? Has there ever been threats to the pink jersey? Because we've seen at the Vuelta, of course, the leader's jersey has changed colour over the years, which I think has damaged the brand there, as it were.
No, La Maglia Rosa has never really come into question. What has been
more imperiled really has been La Gazzetta, which has seen its circulation figures tumble over the last few years, like most written press all over, well, Europe and the world. La Gazzetta is now, I think I'm right, it's in the fourth, has the fourth highest circulation of the Italian papers. The first one is Corriere della Sera, which is based in Milan, about 450,000. Then La Repubblica from Rome, and La Gazzetta is down in fourth place, about 220,000 copies a day.
A lot, isn't it? I mean, one of the things, as with L'Equipe at the Tour, here at the Giro, there's a huge Gazzetta contingent, our friend Ciro Scognamiglio among them, of course. They've got their own little area within the press room every day. They've got a little boxed-off area, so they're kind of put on a slightly higher plane than us mere mortals. Quite a big team.
Quite a lot of journalists, a big team, but only one Ciro.
Hello, listener. It's not a dream. It's real. I'm here with you, also from Andalo.
That, of course, is the voice of Ciro Scognamiglio, who Daniel mentioned at the very end of that clip from this morning.
As I said, there's only one Ciro. No Ciro, no Giro.
Very popular T-shirt available at thecyclingpodcast.com.
Yes, I must confess that I don't have one.
I brought you one, Ciro. I brought you a T-shirt.
Thank you, Rich. It's a kind of Christmas present for me.
It is
thank
a Christmas present. I'm going to give it to you tomorrow. You're going to wear it for the rest of the Giro.
Why not?
More importantly, Richard, when I just called Ciro, there's a kind of bat phone that we call to get Ciro on the podcast. He's in the press room. He's busy tapping away, and
he's in the Gazzetta pod.
Yeah, and we just lift up the receiver on the bat phone, and we call him. Anyway, when I did speak to him a few minutes ago, he said, "Hey, I have a bomb for you, a bomba." Ciro, what's the bombshell that's just dropped?
Yes, as you can easily imagine, and dear listeners, it's something that belongs to the figure of the peacock of Sandrigo, Filippo Pozzato. So be careful. This morning, I was in the bus of his team, Villiers Autista, so inside his bus, but I didn't go to see him, but I went here to realize an interview with his teammate Daniel Martinez. Is the young Colombian rider, is the youngest in this Giro, only 20 years old. And the listeners, people was really upset because he was jealous. Yes, in a certain way. He said, "But what's happening? You are not here for me?" So if people will listen this podcast, certainly he doesn't speak English at all, and so maybe he doesn't understand anything, but I want to say to people and to you, dear listeners, people, I'm always in love with you, so don't worry, don't be jealous.
Thanks for clearing that up, Ciro. It's been the big question on everybody's lips today on the Giro. Anything to say about the stage and Vincenzo Nibali? What on earth has happened to Vincenzo?
Well, it's certainly now. We just to be serious, it's difficult, but I will try. And yes, maybe something happening to Vincenzo in these days, because now also this stage, he tried to attack, but at the end, it was another bad day for him. So, well, there could be several reasons, maybe hard to find only one, maybe some difficulty in preparations, maybe they committed some mistake, but certainly in the last years, it's one in a certain way of the worst Nibali. Certainly he always fought in the GC. I don't want to say that, okay, he's completely gone. But if we compare also with the Tour de France, okay, we remember that in the last Tour de France, he was very bad in the first part, but then in third week, he was really strong. He also arrived to the fourth place. He won a stage. Now in this moment, it's very difficult for him, yeah.
Well, Richard, this morning in Bressanone, I actually spoke to Nibali's coach, Paolo Slongo, about his poor performances in the Dolomites, the poor performance at Corvara and also Alpe di Siusi the following day. And here is what Slongo said. You're going to hear it in Italian and then we'll just explain.
Per dire la verità, noi dello staff abbiamo analizzato le varie componenti, però elementi per dire che stava male non ce ne sono. È proprio una giornata, magari dove lo sforzo il giorno prima è stata recuperata un po' meno, una giornata no.
So that was Paolo Slongo just really confirming what he's been saying to Ciro the last few days, that the Astana staff have analysed Nibali's performances and they've analysed the physiological data and they don't really see a problem. They're kind of puzzled and they're kind of perplexed. And I think Emilio Magni, the Astana doctor who I also spoke to this morning, he has said after today's stage that they will probably do some tests over the next few days to try and get to the bottom of exactly what's wrong with Nibali.
Exactly. And after the stage, they are even more convinced of them, and so they will for sure realize some extra analysis tests in order to try to understand what's happening.
He doesn't look, he's not pedaling fluidly, is he? He doesn't look like the Nibali of old. He's a lovely rider to watch, Nibali, when he's on form. He, you know, he's very stylish. He might have been a strong contender for Pedlar de Charme on several previous days,
yeah.
But he's not looking like he's got that zip.
No, we've spoken a bit on the podcast about the changes he's made this year. We spoke about the pedal cranks, which doesn't seem to be a big issue. Slongo said to me this morning that, you know, changing the length of the pedal cranks, it kind of made that much difference. But there are other things. For example, I spoke to Emilio Magni this morning about the changes in his diet this winter. And he observed, well, he went on, I suppose it's kind of an Atkins diet, the diet that became very popular a few years ago, where you eliminate carbohydrates and only proteins and fats, essentially. And, you know, it occurred to me that Nibali is not really a rider who is well known for having problems with weight. But the reason supposedly that they experimented with this for around a month was that, you know, Magni said that usually he's spent a month in the winter just trying to lose weight, and they really didn't want to do that. They wanted him to really hit the ground running. But it's a change, and it's something that he wasn't used to. And I mean, I also found it interesting that over the last couple of days and in the rest day as well, for the first time, we really heard Nibali talk about pressure and stress and the pressure of expectation. And, you know, Nibali is a kind of easy breezy character, and he's a very relaxed character. And that's always struck me as his great strength, that his sort of immunity to stress. But it seems that on this Giro, the expectation, the almost demands from the fans for him to win have maybe affected him.
It's funny you should say that about his weight, because I remember at the Tour a couple of years ago, Chris Froome said that, or actually it might have been last year, said that Nibali had, people look at Froome as the kind of the skinniest, leanest rider out there, and he said that Nibali's BMI, his body mass index, was lower than his. I don't know how he knew that, but, you know, he doesn't necessarily look that skinny to look at, but apparently Nibali is somebody with very low body fat, so I don't know why he'd go on a diet.
Well, I mean, certainly it's something that belongs to daughter or the factor of diets. But going back about the Daniel's word, about the question of pressure around Nibali, this is important in my opinion, because exactly we are used to consider Nibali really far from the pressure. But as a matter of fact, maybe it's a mistake, especially after his victory of Tour de France 2014. Maybe this something changed in his attitude around all the pressure that are with him.
Se il lupo non avesse insistito tanto nell'argomentare che piacesse o meno a noi italiani, era la maglia gialla del Tour il traguardo più ambito da ogni ciclista del pianeta, io mi sarei anche dato una calmata.
If the Wolf hadn't been so insistent in arguing that whether we Italians liked it or not, it was the yellow jersey of the Tour de France that every cyclist on the planet really dreamed of, I would have calmed down.
Well, the shark may be sinking in this Giro because he's not moving forward quickly enough, but he's still very much propelling himself forward in our daily installments of The Shark's Tale. And there was a wolf in there as well.
There was a wolf in there, and a couple of cryptic but important references, I feel, and I'm going to explain them now, Richard. So the wolf, Vincenzo Nibali's father, who is called Ciro?
Salvatore, the father of Vincenzo. Yeah.
Salvatore, his nickname when Vincenzo started cycling and when Salvatore was also cycling was the wolf. In that clip, you heard Vincenzo explaining that in the wolf's eyes, or the wolf always tried to explain to Vincenzo that the Tour de France was the most important race in the year. Now, I think that's significant in the sense that Nibali could now find himself targeting the Tour de France because the Giro is going badly wrong, and, you know, he was always going to do the Tour, but now he might shift his focus slightly to start thinking about doing the general classification in the Tour. Bad news for Fabio.
Fabio Aru,
of course. Secondly, on the wolf, the mascot of the Giro d'Italia is called Wolfie, and it's a small, cuddly wolf.
And there have been some protests or some threats of protests in the past few days from French farmers. We all know the Giro is due to go into France on Friday and on Saturday, due to spend a bit of time in France. And the French farmers are not very happy because they think that Wolfie, the cuddly mascot of the Giro d'Italia, is a kind of provocation. And I actually spoke to some people from RCS, the organisers of the Giro, tonight, and they've confirmed to me that Wolfie will no longer be presented on the podium when the Giro goes to France, and it will not even be sold, I don't think, on the merchandising.
Danny, you're really good at pursuing the hard questions, going after the real. That's fantastic.
But listeners, life is very strange. I mean, I can't believe about this news. How is it possible? French farmers, they have no other worries maybe in their life, but okay.
They've lost a lot of sheep.
Maybe.
Not to cuddly mascots, Daniel, to real wolves rather than cuddly Giro mascots. I'm more interested in the fact that Nibali refers to his father as the wolf. That to me, that's remarkable.
Shocking, isn't it?
Really shocking, but it was also shocking for me listening to Daniel about the possible problems in Astana, in the Tour, because Nibali and Aru will be in the same team and in the same race. So, listeners, can you imagine really how hard will be my month of July every day to write about this stuff?
Brilliant. We can't wait to hear your insights.
Anyway, Ciro, something else very significant. I want to get you on this before you have to leave. Today was the anniversary of Operación Puerto breaking 10 years ago. We were at the Giro. I remember being at Monte Bondone. Ivan Basso just won by a large margin,
who says that Alejandro Valverde doesn't have a sense of poetry winning?
Yeah, and then the news came through of Manolo Saiz being arrested, Eufemiano Fuentes. That was 10 years ago exactly to the day, and who should win today but Alejandro Valverde, a confirmed client of Eufemiano Fuentes.
Daniel, maybe you are not seeing me before while I was writing my article about Valverde, but I was writing exactly this stuff. It's almost incredible that in this day, in the Giro, in Italy, because we all know that the sanction to Valverde was done by, in a certain way, the Italian CONI, the Italian Olympic Committee. It's something incredible that he win today after 10 years. It's something, it's a kind of film, but listeners, the problem is that it's not a film.
Film noir.
And it's reality, and now I have to work, I have to write. Goodbye.
Okay, bye, Giro. But yeah, Valverde.
He's gone. He's off.
Valverde, 36 years old. And, you know, it is remarkable.
Pity, don't say a pity.
I'm not saying pity. I see what you're doing there. No, it is remarkable that he should win today. It's not because it was exactly the sort of stage that suited him, but on this 10-year anniversary.
Yeah, and the 10-year anniversary hasn't had that much attention, has it? There was an interview yesterday on Velo News by our colleague Andy Hood. He interviewed Jörg Jaksche, the former German rider who was also a client of Eufemiano Fuentes, and Jaksche suggesting that nothing has changed in the last 10 years. Jörg is currently studying economics in Sydney and hasn't had a lot of contact with professional cycling over the last few years. He's an intelligent guy. I don't think he would say things that he didn't believe. However, I would question really how much information he has about how much hasn't changed over the last 10 years. It certainly feels like a very different place, the Giro and professional cycling, from what it was 10 years ago.
Yeah, it does. And he's a very engaging guy, Jaksche. He does enjoy chatting, doesn't he? And he enjoys, you know, sharing. And
as Lance Armstrong told me, oh, that guy was like a radio.
So he's just, journalists phone him up and he comes out with the same stuff all the time, and you know, I'm sure he believes it, but I would, like you, Daniel, question how connected he is to the current sort of peloton, the current scene. Now, on Operation Puerto, I know this is a bit of a curveball, Daniel, but I've remembered something we've got to include in tonight's episode.
All right, go on.
We are doing a Friends special on Operation Puerto, which will come out before the Tour de France on the 10-year anniversary, because it really erupted enormously on the eve of the 2006 Tour de France. Another French special that we've got coming up is Joe Dombrowski's audio diary of the Giro. Now, Joe Dombrowski is riding really well. He had a cold early on in the Giro. He got over that, gave it to everybody else in the team who are now suffering, but he's got over it. He's fine, and he's flying. And he actually bridged up to the break.
He's pinging, isn't he?
He's pinging. He bridged up to the break and then got dropped on the flat afterwards, and he was very angry with himself about that. He's been recording audio diary every day. It's really good. It's really quite wacky in places. And we're going to play every night this week a little clip. You can become a friend of the podcast at thecyclingpodcast.com. It's £10 for the year. That will give you 11 exclusive podcasts, of which the Joe Dombrowski audio diary from the Giro will be one. And it will come out the week after the Giro. So we'll play little extracts this week. And thank you very much, everybody who has signed up already as a friend. And please do so if you haven't already. Here's a little clip, Joe Dombrowski talking about Italian coffee.
We might get in trouble for saying this, but it's always a little burnt, isn't it?
Yeah, overly roasted. Yeah. They're kind of old school. In that regard.
Yes. Well,
like, I like it, but I kind of like it in the same sense that, like, after 3 days of camping, I like Folgers. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, this is good. It works. That, and in the South, they go, like, super short. Like, it's much more ristretto than espresso.
Yeah. I just know...
syrup.
That, like, if I don't have time to make a cup of coffee in my room...
Yeah.
That, like, at least I'll get something on the way out the door. Something that doesn't come from a machine.
Yeah, but it won't be on the way out the door because it can't come in a plastic cup.
Right, it's just... Oh, yeah, let's talk about that. Let's talk about how people can't comprehend the idea of a to-go coffee here.
Well, like, they have a very... I think Italians, when it comes to food, coffee, whatever, are very, I don't know if stubborn's the word, but, you know, yeah, you can't get anything to go.
No.
But also, at the same time, it's not that they sit around and sip their coffee slowly like Americans do in a coffee shop. Like, very standard procedure, you know, say, because I've done a number of road trips through Italy, very standard is you stop at an auto grill,
mm-hmm.
and they're just cranking out coffees. And I've noticed that Italians, for one, never drink cappuccinos outside of with breakfast, pretty much.
Yep, well, never after 10.
Never after 10. They say noon, but I really think it's 10. And additionally, so they always order espresso when they're at a place like an auto grill, which is more or less like a roadside 7-Eleven.
Mm-hmm. Looks better.
But like way, way better. But they also always drink coffee standing up. And it's almost like it doesn't really mean anything to them. It's just like a purely for caffeine.
Yeah, it's just an input process.
Like they could just as easily inject it and it would be the same thing.
Eurosport, the home of cycling.
Thank you to Eurosport for sponsoring our Daily Pedaler de Charme Award. And we've been getting rid of some t-shirts recently. We were early visitors this morning to the Team Giant Alpecin Hotel, and we met Georg Preidler, who was our Pedaler de Charme the other day. We gave him a t-shirt and we had a little chat with him.
We talked to him about his studies, didn't we? Because I was very intrigued by something I read a few days ago, that he's studying mining engineering, and I wanted to check that out with him this morning, whether that was true or not.
So let's hear the Preidler de Charme.
I said you were doing mining studies.
Yeah.
And I wasn't sure whether that was correct or not, whether you'd finished the studies. Can you just tell us if you are or not still?
No, I haven't finished it yet. I'm stuck in the middle somewhere, because since I turned pro, there's not so much time left anymore for studying. But yeah, it's my goal to finish it during and after my career.
Is this with a view to going into that business when you finish cycling, or...?
Yeah, I'm not sure yet, actually, because I also really like the sport and somehow would like to stay in the sport, but I have to decide that when I'm done with it.
I was speaking to Albert Timmer, your teammate earlier, who said that you don't feel the Giro in your legs, you're feeling better every day. Is that right?
Well, I wouldn't say that. I'm also getting tired, but so far this Giro this year, it feels easier to me. It's also nice with those kind of time trials before the rest day. So if you don't go full on the time trial, you have almost 2 rest days.
So you're looking forward to these stages still to come?
Yeah, for sure. I'm really looking forward to them.
Get that stage win.
Yeah, hopefully.
And just finally, what does it mean to you? You've had the pink jersey in the team, but this surely is a greater honour to have the Pedler de Charme t-shirt in your team.
Yeah, it's a big honour, for sure.
So that was Georg Preidler, who obviously was ecstatic to win Pedler de Charme.
Never has a team shown more interest in the criteria for the Pedler de Charme.
Remarkable.
We sat with Luke Roberts, who's a DS there, or a coach at Giant Alpecin, and Mark Reef, and we discussed for a good 3 minutes
what
exactly went into the selection process, the nomination process.
Today was such a late start in the stage that the riders were able to get up, have breakfast, and kind of go back to bed for a bit, which at this stage in a race must have been most welcome. We went in and said, Preidler had gone back up to his room, but we said, oh, we'll not disturb him now, he's probably resting. And Mark Reef was insistent they could call him back down.
There have been a few tenuous but admirable links tonight, and I want to make another one, Richard. You mentioned riders in bed. This morning we started in...
You've been mentioning that enough. We started
this morning in Bressanone, and I learned today that Bressanone was the birthplace of the most famous prison breaker or fugitive probably in Italian history, a guy called Max Leitner, who's in jail now. He's finally been caught, but he broke out of jails 5 times. He was a bank robber, and he's been dubbed the modern-day Italian Robin Hood. And one of his methods for escaping prison was to wrap himself in sheets and pretend...
A Pedler de Charme t-shirt.
In sheets and pretend that he was dirty laundry. And he managed to get out 5 times.
Brilliant. That's great. Great. That's
and then, and we can also link, because we can also talk about breakaways, and we can also link to back to today's stage, and we can talk about Ilnur Zakarin, can't we?
Well, funny you should say that, Daniel, because this is almost like it's scripted, isn't it? Today's Pedler de Charme, I've been wanting a sense of perverse irony or
very
something.
Perverse, yeah.
Because Zakarin is not the most elegant of peddlers. But there were quite a few nominations for him to win Pedler de Charme today.
The one thing about Zakarin, well, perhaps in some people's minds there are many things, but the one really endearing feature about Zakarin's riding is that it's quite naive and it's very generous. Like, you know, you saw him with Kreuzwerk and Valverde there in the finale, and he worked an awful lot in a position, in circumstances where, okay, he had to gain time, or it was in his interest to gain time on general classification, but in those circumstances, an awful lot of more experienced riders, cannier riders would have been looking to Kreuzwerk and saying, you're the pink jersey, you've got everything to gain here, get on the front. And Zakarin did the majority of the work there.
He's like a big dog, isn't he? He's like sort of big, bounding
bandy leg dog, yeah.
He is. I mean, he's up to fifth overall at 450. The podium is in his sights, I would say. I mean, Valverde's looking pretty good at 323, but, you know, the podium's maybe a possibility. Valverde would need to collapse like he did on Saturday, but Zakarin has bounced back from his terrible crashes in the time trial.
It's been a good performance overall. I mean, coming into this Giro, there was the suspicion that he was going to take the Giro by storm and rip everyone's legs off and produce the kind of surprise performance that he's produced before the Tour de Romandie last year. He hasn't quite done that. He hasn't pulled up any trees, but he has been solid. And as you say, Rich, he goes now into the last few stages with a good shot, with a genuine chance of finishing on the podium.
More importantly, he is also today's Pedler de Charme. And tomorrow morning, I'm going to dispatch Daniel to the Katusha bus with a pedler.
I've never
seen a look of... And you're gonna go and speak to Mr. Ekimov.
Again?
Which you like to do. Well, we're going to hear from Ekimov in a moment, aren't we? You're going to speak to Mr. Ekimov and ask if you can speak to Mr. Zakarin and present him with a Pedler de Charme t-shirt. Good luck with that. And let's hear now from Vyacheslav Ekimov.
Was that the best Ilnur Zakarin we've seen of the Giro so far?
Well, we still have 2 months on stages, so we hope that he continue going with the same speed, with the same legs, and we will see. So there is obviously... I would say he is with the first guys in the mountains. Don't look at the Kruiswijk. But by the way, he didn't pass yet the bad day. Normally it's one day usually happen in the Grand Tours. So we will see. Keep optimistic for, I would say, potential podium place. But obviously the fourth place is obviously possible.
And are you satisfied generally with his performance in the Giro?
Oh yeah, for sure. Basically, what we have planned, we plan them to be captain of the team. We try to see him a Grand Tour rider, and basically, this is the first exam for Ilnur to be like a Grand Tour rider. So, which is obviously a tough position in professional cycling.
He seems a very generous rider in the sense that on the finale there, he was doing an awful lot of work when a lot of riders would have been looking at Stephen Kreiswijk and maybe saying, "You come through." But that's kind of typical of Ilnur, isn't he? He really contributes a lot in those groups.
Well, he's still young. He still has to learn a lot. He's not still Alejandro Arvelli, who is clever, I would say, or more experienced. But the thing is, the positive thing is that he's keep trying. You know, he's keep trying. The sport director is behind with the radio, so he can always adjust something or give some better instructions than he might think what to do. So it's good. It's good school. It's good. It's good exam, as I said before, for Ilnur.
You are listening to the cycling podcast at the Giro d'Italia, supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much to Science in Sport, who are sponsoring us at this Giro d'Italia. And you can get 20% off. They're offering 20% off to listeners of the cycling podcast during the Giro. Just enter the code SIS20, that's SIS20, when you make a purchase at www.scienceandsport.com. And if you do purchase things, and lots of you have, it's good for us because I think, you know, sponsors take a bit of a risk sponsoring a podcast, and we're very grateful to them.
As you said earlier in the Giro, Rich, we fill our boots, don't we? But well, not with energy gel.
No, don't fill your boots with energy gel. I thought we covered that already. But that would be a sticky mess. So, yes, thank you very much, Science and Sport. Very much appreciate it. Their sponsorship, and as well as Eurosport's sponsorship, allows us to be here. We also must say thanks again to Maserati, who've given us a Quattroporte car. And you'll be hearing a bit more about that in a special episode of Kilometre Zero coming out after the Giro, which will cover our journey around Italy. We should also mention on Kilometre Zero, we released one on coffee that came out on Monday on the rest day. On Wednesday, we've got another one coming out on nutrition, and we've got a final one to come on Friday. So, a final one before the final one. Any other business from today, Daniel?
Well, there was at the start this morning in Bressanone. We were busy, weren't we?
We're always busy.
Doing our thing in and around the team buses. Obviously, one of the big stories of the rest day was the news, the very bad news for cycling, a very unfortunate news that I am cycling or yam cycling, as more learned pronouncers tend to call them. The Swiss team are going to close at the end of the season. They've had a mixed time, really, in the World Tour, certainly. And their founder and owner, Michel Tétaz, has decided to call it a day. And, you know, there were murmurings that this would happen a few weeks ago, and that the team has certainly not done particularly well in terms of results throughout their time in the World Tour. And they've not won any really big races, have they? And you know, they signed Sylvain Chavanel when they launched, and Jérôme Pinot were their two big signings. They didn't quite come off. Heinrich Hausler was another big name who, by his own admission, has not performed quite to the levels that he had prior to joining Yam Cycling. And so the team is closing, all the riders looking for a new home for next year, 2017. I mentioned Heinrich Hausler. Just before the start in Bressanone this morning, I sidled over and grabbed a quick word with Heinrich to try to assess what the mood was like, having got that bad news yesterday.
Well, obviously yesterday you had some bad news, or the bad news was communicated to the press about the team stopping. I mean, how is morale in the team this morning, and how's it been over the last 24 hours?
Oh, obviously yesterday morning when we received the email from Michelle, everyone was a little bit, wouldn't say like shocked. I mean, we knew the news was going to come. We didn't know if it was going to be positive or negative, but we knew that we were going to receive information about the team's future. Obviously, a lot of us and also the staff, you know, were in shock and a little bit upset. But I mean, you have to also give it to Michelle. It's fair enough. You know, it is, or it's May. It's not August or September or October. I've been in other situations where, you know, we've received the information in September, October, and then you stand there with like pretty much with nothing. So, you know, you have your own future in your hands. You just have to get out there and get the results. And I mean, it was also money coming out of his own pocket. It's not like a big, like, you know, like Sony or Coca-Cola or VW or something, you know. It's like, it's coming out of his own pocket, and he has to do that every year. And he said he, you know, he achieved what he wanted to do, and so, you know, that it's his team, it's his money, he can pretty much do what he wants.
And you have been in this situation before with Cervelo test team. Does that make it slightly easier for you personally to deal with?
Just the fact that it's May, it makes it easy, you know. But still, even now in a Grand Tour, you know, if you want to get your name out there, put yourself out there, then you go in the group today and you smash it, and then you try and go for the sprint tomorrow. And also, you know, just there's too much, so much time and so many races left, where you've got the chance to, you know, you've got your future in your own hands, so you just need to do it.
Your own future, I mean, how much are you thinking about next year, and what are your ideas pretty clear about that already?
Well, you know, Michel already said last year in September, October, that he was going to give an announcement during May how the team's future is going to be like, and if it will continue or stop. So we all kind of knew the news was coming. We've already been speaking with my manager to other teams, just like to have a backup. And, you know, I still want to continue. I've still got a lot left in me. I changed for the first time in my life. You know, I've got a trainer now since last year. And, you know, I'm not saying my classics campaign was awesome, but it was a better one. And, you know I can mix it up there just by pretty much changing my training, actually training less, just different. So, you know, I'm 32, but I still, you know, I want to race. I love the one-day races. So I'd like to go into a team, you know, that also shares that same kind of passion for classics.
So we heard there from Heinrich Hausler. I haven't checked his name on the results yet. I hope he actually made it to the start, because he was still chatting to you, Daniel, long after all the other riders had disappeared.
He's a very talkative kind of fella, is Heinrich.
Maybe he's just a very engaging interviewer.
Well, no, he's always been a very interesting guy to speak to, very almost unfiltered, really. He's quite spontaneous. He sort of tells it like it is. And as he said there, he hopes certainly to prolong his career beyond the end of this season. I'm sure there are some guys in that team who, as I said, have struggled for results, who will be very nervous now about whether they will still be professional cyclists this time next year.
They're nervous every year because they're all on one-year contracts.
Well, they are, and that's been one of the problems. You know, there are a lot of riders on that team who will be very attractive to prospective suitors. One of them is riding here at the Giro in Vegard Stecker Lengen, who we saw on the stage at Asolo, was quite prominent. I think Sky might be quite interested in him, among other teams. Lots of rumours, of course, at the moment, not only regarding Yam Cycling, but various other teams. The Gazzetta dello Sport reported erroneously this morning that Astana had effectively come to an agreement with Peter Sagan to sign him next year. That is a long way from the truth, is what my sources were telling me this morning. Sagan probably, well, I think he will meet Astana, and he will meet Specialized, the bike suppliers to Astana, at the end of this week, or certainly Sagan's representatives will. And Astana is still a possibility, but Astana only have an option with Specialized next year. It's no foregone conclusion that Specialized will supply their bikes. And Specialized are really trying to scale down their operations, or they're thinking about scaling down their operations. They currently supply three World Tour teams, Tinkoff, Astana and Etix. And it may be that next year they're only supplying a couple at most. And really, the Sagan deal and the kind of figures being mentioned for Sagan, we've talked about it before in the podcast, are, by most estimates, well, the estimates of most team managers, out of proportion.
Probably greater than the entire budget for the IAM Cycling team.
Well, almost. I mean, we're talking about what Sagan's agent, Giovanni Lombardi, is proposing is a deal that involves a few riders and also soigneurs, possibly mechanic, and you're talking around 6-7 million euros a year for the whole package. And a lot of people have said to us over the past few years that even Sagan's current deal, which I think is worth about 4 million euros, has distorted and in a certain way damaged the economic system of professional cycling. Domestics aren't necessarily earning more. In fact, in some cases, they might be earning less, but the top earners are on almost footballers' wages. And, you know, you see a team like IAM Cycling closing and other teams with economic problems, Tinkoff pulling out, and you have to wonder whether someone needs to reevaluate, really.
There's a lot to be said about this. We were talking about it a little bit in the car, about the economics of professional cycling, that fewer riders earning more money undermines the whole team structure. Agents getting increasingly involved also inflates the salaries of the big stars.
And an agent's, not in every case certainly, but agents who often have a large portfolio of clients, and of course they're taking a certain percentage. You don't really know exactly what percentage it is, but obviously their percentage from someone like Peter Sagan is going to be an awful lot higher than their percentage from a domestique who's earning 40,000 euros a year. So whose interests are they going to look after first? It's going to be someone like Peter Sagan. But then Peter Sagan's salary, of course, has a knock-on effect on the domestiques, because there's less money available in the team, sloshing around in the team war chest. So it is a tricky one, and there's so much talk these days about increasing revenue in professional cycling and making professional cycling richer. But I think, as I mentioned in the podcast a while ago, I think Beppe Saronni, the manager of Lampre Merida, made a good point a few months ago, saying that really, rather than thinking about increasing revenues, teams should be thinking about becoming more efficient and spending the money that they have in more sensible ways.
Like I Am Cycling, I mean, they've been pretty, that's been part of the problem, that they haven't really splashed out an awful lot on riders and they've not had results. So it's a bit of a chicken and egg situation. And we were talking also about value for money, and Sagan, you know, of all the individuals in the world, offers the best value in terms of he's racing all year round, he's got this exposure, whereas Sagan, you know, you could pay for three GC riders for what you would pay Sagan and risk all three of them.
Well, yeah, and we've spoken about BMC Racing. BMC Racing have got two very big money GC riders who at this point in the year are not racing. Richie Porte and TJ Van Garderen. Van Garderen didn't race Tour of California. It's the biggest stage race on American soil. He wasn't there. And, you know, they'll go to the Tour de France, presumably not realistically thinking that they're going to win the race, but they're on an awful lot of money. Sagan represents great value, I would suggest, compared to riders like that who are a big gamble, in my view. But does Sagan justify, you know, does he bring in 4 million euros worth of bike sales? Well, no, you can emphatically say that he doesn't, and you know, people in bike companies will tell you that. So it's a tricky one, and as long as team managers will be held to ransom by agents and by riders, then it will continue to happen and it will probably get worse.
Now we should wrap up there, Daniel. We've gone on long enough. We could go on about this for a long time. The Giro's still very interesting, still lots to happen, still very difficult stages ahead. So let's say cheerio for tonight. Thank you very much, Daniel.
Thank you, Richard.